Lecture 9. Bronte, Wuthering Heights, Part 2.
In this concluding lecture on Wuthering Heights, I'm going to steer us a little bit towards the dark side of things in order to further explain why I think it's sort of insufficient to term this text romantic, which is how most people regard it. It might be more accurate to say that this text is pathological. It's about mania. But to take it out of that medical discourse, perhaps one can say it's also about the poisonous consequences of both cruelty and love. Consequences that cruelty and love live on, that they don't stop when you think they do, when some of the actors themselves die. And in that sense, the story almost has a Greek feeling. It reminds me a little bit of the Oresteia, of revenge, of cycles of revenge, because the figure of Heathcliff only makes sense to me in that sense. So Catherine's grand pronouncement, "I am Heathcliff," even if it seems to us the kind of romantic epitome of desire, it comes early in the book, and we don't really expect, as we're reading it, for things to go as badly as they're going to. The book obliges us increasingly to measure what it means to be somebody else as well as to be oneself. So plot-wise, once Heathcliff leaves because he has heard only a portion of Catherine's remarks to Nellie, thinks that Catherine looks down on him, he leaves, and she soon enough marries the very likable Edgar Linton, who was crazy about her, and she moves into Thrushcross Grange. A few years later, and this is classic novelistic behavior, romantic logic, I suppose, Heathcliff returns out of nowhere. And he returns completely altered. He's handsome. He's rich. He's impressively endowed. He was a kid when he left. He exudes a sense of power and arrogance and authority. And, not surprisingly, he pronounces an implacable judgment on the events that have taken place since he's been gone. He indicts Edgar as an impossible match for Catherine, for someone of her vitality and generosity. He sort of refers to him as the slavering and shivering thing, says that you may have preferred to me. This is crazy. How could you have done this? He also, at one point, actually compares this marriage as if someone had planted an oak in a flower pot and expected it to survive. In other words, Edgar can't possibly be the appropriate figure for Catherine. But what he says about Edgar is really small beer in comparison to the indictment, the really withering indictment, that he gives to Catherine for what she has done. Because in betraying him, she's betrayed herself. And now we begin to see what the consequences are of "I am Heathcliff." That none of your acts has the same autonomy that you always assume they have. That if I do this, I do this. I'll take my licks for if it's wrong. But it doesn't occur to most of us that we're acting for two people in this regard. And so Catherine, who is faced with the return of Heathcliff and his insistence on the wreckage that this marriage has wrought, can't bear it. And the book is really merciless. It's unsparing in its almost clinical account of the way these two go at each other, the way Heathcliff bears down on Catherine to tell her in great detail how unbearable it is and how criminal it is what she's done. And again, we think of most arguments as A telling B that what B has done is wrong because A thinks it is wrong. But none of that will wash in this book, because what Heathcliff is saying to her is that everything you have done has to do with us. And all of my own language is far too feeble here. And let me cite some of this and you get a better feeling for it. First of all, she is becoming ill. She cannot bear, because his very presence when he returns is a kind of unmistakable proof of how badly she has managed her life, what she has lost in giving up Heathcliff and in marrying Edgar. And when the two of them see each other, Heathcliff is banished from the property. Edgar can't bear to have him there. But he comes anyway. He can't be stopped. I think that's a general truth about Heathcliff. He can't be stopped. And this is the way Nellie tells it when the two see each other. Catherine made a spring, and he caught her, and they were locked in an embrace from which I thought my mistress would never be released alive. And a moment later, Nellie writes, he gnashed at me and foamed like a mad dog. It sounds like a rabid dog, doesn't it? And gathered her to him with greedy jealousy. I want you to hear the animalism here. This isn't psychology. This is something much more elemental and primitive than psychology. And that's what Nellie says. I did not feel as if I were in the company of a creature of my own species. It's as if you're leaving the human altogether. And it's after that that Heathcliff explodes into this indictment. Why did you betray your own heart, Kathy? I have not one word of comfort. And here she is dying. I mean, you would expect that this is when this man would treat her. He does love her, obviously. Treat her with kindness and gentleness. Well, forget it. There is no kindness and gentleness in this book. He says, I have not one word of comfort. You deserve this. You have killed yourself. And that, again, is part of the weird logic, the boomerang logic of this book, that what you do that you think is going out there is actually homing. It's coming in. It's being done to yourself. You loved me. Then what right had you to leave me? Because misery and degradation and death and nothing that God or Satan could inflict would have parted us. You, of your own will, did it. I have not broken your heart. You have broken it. And again, the implacable logic. And in breaking it, you've broken mine. It's as if they share the same apparatus. It's as if looking at these two people were a visual mirage. You see two people retinally, but that's not the truth of it. The moral and the affective and the spiritual truth of it is that it's one person in two bodies. Nellie, I am Heathcliff, is what she said. And we're beginning to see what that means. Catherine can't bear it. If I've done wrong, I'm dying for it. It is enough. You left me too. But I won't upbraid you. I forgive you. Forgive me. And this is like a deathbed request. And again, he's insistent. I forgive what you have done to me. I love my murderer. But yours? How can I? I mean, this thing is fabulously twisted, fabulously ingrown. It almost has a kind of mathematical horror to it. We are so accustomed to the I versus the world split. It's a kind of fiction that our skin convinces us of, that our craft makes its way throughout the world. It's ensconced in our body, our mind, our apparatus, and the rest of the world is, in some sense, at arm's length, and I don't think any human being escapes that feeling. It's not always a happy situation. This book annihilates that notion. This is a book where those contours are just simply blown to smithereens. It doesn't happen that way. These two people experience themselves as one and therefore horribly vulnerable, interdependent. So that's really, I believe, the most far-reaching logic of this book. Is that it ruptures our customary sense of things about where our contours stop, where our edges stop. Those edges are being erased here. Thus, it's perfectly appropriate that Heathcliff is going to essentially curse Catherine as she's dying. And I want you to hear this. Catherine Earnshaw, may you not rest as long as I am living. You said I killed you. Haunt me, then. The murdered do haunt their murderers. Be with me always. This is right after she has died. He's speaking to the corpse. He even says, drive me mad. All of these are simply ways of instancing her, of proving that she is there, that she's inhabiting him, that she still lives. I cannot live without my life. I cannot live without my soul. You know, one hears of these horrible kinds of surgical crimes where someone is knocked on the head or whatever, and they wake up and someone has stolen one of their organs. You hear about this happening in some countries because organs are so vital. Sort of this passage makes me think of that. I cannot live without my soul. She's got his soul in hock. She has it, just as he has hers. Again, our sense of a kind of fundamental integrity of the body and of the person is just blown away here. This is also the kind of invocation for a haunting. I want you to haunt me, to torment me, because that's always further proof that our love is still real, that you are still there, that you're a living part of me. And I think this sends us back, in some sense, to the child ghost who haunted at the beginning of the book, Lockwood. And when Lockwood rubs that child's hand over the glass pane, that's the ghost that wants in. That ghost still lives. Our boundaries, including the boundary that we think death offers, those boundaries are eroded here. They're erased. So this installs a view of human experience and human sentiment that's different from what realist novels offer us. You won't find anything like this in Balzac. And it seems to me that Bronte also takes certain notions and pushes them further than we're accustomed, that the behavior of these characters is not only extreme, it seems pathological, it seems diseased, that we think that such things as self-control make sense, but these characters are among the most extreme in literature. And the book treats us to a number of scenes where we realize just how uncontrollable these people are, just how, I mean, we have that terrible phrase, people being a loose cannon. Well, but that sort of artillery model, it seems to me, works here. And it tests as well the effectiveness of a narrator like Nellie Dean, who misconstrues these things. I mean, Catherine, when she's dying, is shrieking to Nellie. She speaks about 1,000 smith's hammers, she says, that beat in her head. And she tries to tell Nellie, I'm going to explode. It's going crazy inside of me. And then she says things like, I'll break their hearts by breaking my own. I mean, that's one of the childlike remarks of this book. We've all seen children who threaten you in that way. But you can't distinguish here. You can't draw a line between the adult emotions of passion. I'm not sure where to put the sexual in this book. Some people have thought that this book is about incest. I can't quite see it. I'm not sure how libidinal this is or how somatic. I really believe it's spiritual. These two people are inseparable. They share each other. They can't not share each other. They can't get clear of each other. And they both want it to be that way because it's the most viable proof that they still live. Well, I think most of us, once we begin to see this part of the book, this dimension of this book, this sort of dark reach of the book, we begin to realize this is not going to end well. This is not going to do well. And so these characters, you begin to realize, I mean, today we have so many terms for this. We talk about certain kinds of psychoses, and we talk about certain kinds of mental disorders. I think Bronte's book can be very profitably read in those terms, that these are characters who are deranged. Heathcliff's return causes what we'd have to call a meltdown in Catherine. And before she dies, I mean, she does some pretty dreadful things. Edgar, as I said, wants to banish Heathcliff. He doesn't want this man near him at all. And Catherine locks the door when Heathcliff is there, locks the door so that Edgar cannot get rid of Heathcliff. Edgar has wanted to call his servants to upbraid or thrash Heathcliff. She locks the door and she says, okay, you want him out, you take him out. She doesn't use those words, but that's pretty much what, mano a mano is pretty much what she's saying. It's brutal. It's Darwinian. This book just simply discards our kind of polite cover for human relations and human arrangements. It takes it really right down to the elemental core, down to the bone, down to the nerve. At what point when, because this is something that I haven't yet told you, that Heathcliff is also kind of dashingly attractive, romantic figure for women, and in particular, Isabella, who is Edgar's sister, is utterly enamored of him. And this is something that Catherine can see, and she's not even bothered by it. She knows that she and Heathcliff are cut out of the same cloth, or of the same flesh and bone. She knows he can't be interested in Isabella, but she tries to tell Isabella. She says at one point, he's not a rough diamond, a pearl-containing oyster of a rustic. He is a fierce, pitiless, wolfish man. That's clairvoyant. That's lucid. He's a fierce, pitiless, wolfish man. These people see clear. They know what they're dealing with. They know there's nothing soft and fuzzy about the romantic interactions in place here. Instead, they're death-dealing. They cannot be polished. The raw can't turn into the cooked, put it that way. And so we get a feeling that this can't find a resolution. And of course, I think that's why she dies. His presence is too much. She's being invaded by tumult, being wrought up by these sort of unresolvable feelings and tensions. She moves towards collapse and she dies, and that's when Heathcliff invokes her dead body to haunt him. But if Catherine is mercurial, Heathcliff is volcanic. Heathcliff surpasses her in rage and fury in a way, not just Catherine, who's already quite a number on that front. He is almost immeasurable in his own violence, and people have related this to the Gothic genre, these sort of extreme, dark statements about human passion and violence and frenzy. But here's a characteristic one. I have no pity. This is after she's dead. This is what it means for her to haunt him, is that she nourishes his rage. She's like a succubus. She's inside of him. She's part of the venom that is life-sustaining for him. I have no pity. I have no pity. The more the worms writhe, the more I yearn to crush out their entrails. It is a moral teething. He has, by the way, married Isabella. Talk about trouble. He's married her. She's enamored of him. He's married her. He's going to treat her with utmost brutality. It is a moral teething, the way babies teethe. And I grind with greater energy in proportion to the increase of pain. Reminds me of that first passage about grinding that child's wrists over the broken glass. But Heathcliff takes it sort of as his standard, as his banner. This is how he will treat people. This is how he, in fact, treats Isabella. At one point, he remarks that he would like, if he were married to her, to have her face take on rainbow colors. And you may think, well, what a fanciful epithet that is. But he says something like, to turn her blue eyes black. And we have to realize, he's saying that he is going to beat her so much that she will be black and blue. This behavior stamps him throughout his entire long life. Because Catherine dies very young, Heathcliff will live and preside over the next generation entirely. And when I say entirely, I mean despotically, tyrannically, and monstrously. And when I said there is no softness or gentleness in this book, it's most really frighteningly evident in the treatment of children. And that's a motif that you must have seen already in these lectures, that the child whose wrists, the ghost child whose wrists are brought in over the broken glass, you just take a half step back and say, what an image of child abuse. And it seems to me that that tells us about what's going to come, not just the sadism, but the sadism that is particularly directed towards children. And so Heathcliff is going to be awful to the children who come under his reign, under his control. And Kathy has a daughter from Linton, whose name is Catherine. Heathcliff beats her. We see it graphically in the text. He holds her head with one hand, and he administers a series of slaps with another. She asks for tenderness. She knows that he loved her mother. And he answers, I'd rather be hugged by a snake. He's incorrigible. That the dream of the tortured child, the dream that Lockwood had at the beginning, tells us what this book does. And I want to amplify that a little bit. It also tells us that childhood is a loss that can't be made good. And it tells us that we can look at the behavior of these characters. I've called them pathological. I've spoken to use words like mania. Well, let's use a child's word, tantrum. It's not, I think, implausible to regard the activities of Heathcliff and of Catherine as tantrums, as the kind of wild, erratic, irresponsible, uncontrollable behavior of people who can't grow up, who don't grow up. They remain the wild children on the moors. They can't grow up. They can't forget. They live through, of, by each other. And yet they are only the most visible, mad, angry, deranged people of this book. It would seem to be almost a trademark. Heathcliff, at one point, talks about the way he treats Isabella. I've already told you that he's pretty rough on her. He can be quite abusive. Here's one of his remarks, and I want you to hear in this not only what he does to Isabella, but the kind of general tenor of things at the Grange. The Grange, of course, was the place of refinement when the Lintons lived there. Now that Heathcliff takes it over, and I'm going to say a word about that, taking over, it's under his dominion, and it's a different place. It's like Wuthering Heights. The first thing she saw me do on coming out of the Grange was to hang up her little dog. I can't tell you how many animals are murdered in this book. To hang up her little dog. That doesn't mean to pick up the little dog and put it somewhere. It means to hang it. And when she pleaded for it, the first words I uttered were a wish that I had the hanging of every being belonging to her, except one. Possibly she took that exception for herself. Book has a certain amount of irony in it as well. Heathcliff would like to hang every creature that Isabella is fond of. But no brutality disgusted her. I suppose she has an innate admiration of it. These lines give me pause. No brutality disgusted her. I suppose that she has an innate admiration of it. This is a text where we see so much violence, so much rage, so much anger, that the first thing we think of is, can people be this demented, this uncontrolled, this unable to restrain themselves? But the second thing that we want to think of, which is why I invoked the Oresti and Greek tragedy, is that we see the repercussions of this. We see the impact of this. It's as if, and again, gentle Emily, who lived almost, you know, bedridden, weak, dying, there was a fierceness in that young writer, unlike anything that I know, that there is a sense in which she feels and knows that once you cut underneath the veneer of polished behavior and refinement and logic and rationality, and let's go further, decency, kindness, what you find is pure darkness. You find pure violence, vehemence. I mean, sometimes this reminds me of a theorist like Artaud who talked about cruelty as the sort of bottom level of the human being, the basic level, the elemental level of human nature. This book gives, and it's in that sense that when you read a novel like Jane Eyre by Emily's sister Charlotte, you realize how proper it is. I mean, you know, certainly Mr. Rochester is a kind of cousin of Heathcliff's, but Heathcliff makes Rochester look like a kind of polite gentleman. And he is a polite gentleman, but not so Heathcliff. You can't make a gentleman out of Heathcliff. He's a fiend. It's a word that's used many times in the book. That there's a kind of violence that just simply cannot be overcome. And the remark about Isabella, possibly she took that exception for herself, but no brutality disgusted her. I suppose she has an innate admiration for it. It's a chilling line. It's about the afterlife of cruelty. It's about cruelty as being infectious, contagious. We don't know that Isabella is like that. Most of the depiction of Isabella in the book is not like that. But still, Heathcliff's line gets to me. It suggests that we can infect people with our rage and anger and brutality. We see scenes of Henley hanging dogs, Henley being the older brother of Catherine. We also see the son, Hareton, the Henley's son, killing animals, brutalizing children. It would appear to be virtually the kind of signature behavior in this particular book. And I've stressed all of this, I've emphasized it all, to tell you how difficult it's going to be to clean this up. And that's what the aim of the generational structure of the book is. The first half of the book, by far the best half in my opinion, the first half of the book is the story, fundamentally, of Heathcliff and Catherine. It's the story of this remarkable demonic love between these two people, or between this one person who happens to be two. The second half of the book is where I think it falls off in intensity. It's arguable that no writer could maintain the intensity of the first half. And the second half of the book follows the affairs of the next generation, of the three children, because Catherine herself, the girl Catherine, is married off to Linton, that's the son that Heathcliff has with Isabella, sickly child, certainly not like Heathcliff. Heathcliff is brutal to him too. And Linton dies. Linton is a vicious little boy, by the way. And he dies. And then it turns out that the only male child left, young man, is Hareton, who is the son of Henley. This is really kind of twisted, quasi-incestuous book along those lines. How many different ways the same people can be brought together in marriage. And it closes with our very clear vision that Catherine is going to marry Hareton, and that maybe this will be the way of somehow civilizing the brutal elements of the story. And of course, what does she do with Hareton? And this is classic, an anthropologist couldn't have written it better. She teaches him how to read. It's the very index of turning the raw into the cooked. For my personal taste, it's a bit sappy to watch the antics of the children once you have seen the kind of deadly, fierce, awesome, really magnetic behavior of the adults. Heathcliff lives a long life. He has managed to take on all of the estates. He's the master both of Wuthering Heights and of Thrushcross Grange because he married Isabella. And there, people have read this book along economic terms, that this is a book really about a man garnering great economic power to himself. I don't know how far that goes. I mean, it's true, but I don't know if it'll take us deep enough into the book. As I said, the book is sugared over by the end. We see the next generation cleaning up most of the mess made by the first generation. And yet, the last words of this book are Nellie's words. She's been telling the story to Lockwood. And she's looking at the moths on the heath, and she's listening to the wind. These are the elements. And she wonders, I quote, how anyone could ever imagine unquiet slumbers for the sleepers in that quiet earth. And we know that Heathcliff has arranged to be buried next to Catherine's coffin, and one senses that they are, in fact, not asleep. These are unquiet slumbers, even if the earth is quiet. Thank you.